You're about to enjoy TryHards, courtesy of MTGCast.com. If you enjoy TryHards or anything else supplied by MTGCast, please make a donation. Whether it's recurring or one time, you can help offset the very real overhead of bringing you the best podcasts in magic every week. MTGCast at MTGCast.com.
That playset that you guys opened?
Overpowered, undercosted creatures.
I'm not the primary audience.
Did you give them the room to hit it?
I actually fell asleep.
Hey, middle finger to blue for a couple sets, right?
5 seconds later, I'm signing the match list with a loss.
Be willing to do that as a labor of love.
They got out their $30,000 sets and just went to town on each other.
Oh, you brave soul. Welcome to this episode of TryHards. Coming off of a double GP weekend, why are the Hards feeling suddenly all modern? Are you ready to go for your pre-release experience? We'll pack it all in, as well as a disappointing reaction to the empty white paper released by Wizards. It's this week's episode of TryHards. I'm Sean Seacrease, he's Matt Hurley, and he's Brian Tibbetts. Each week we get it started with something delicious to drink. Matt, what do you have in the glass tonight?
We went to a brandy, gin, and absinthe distillery Sunday when my buddy was in town all weekend. Picked up some gin from there, and I'm just drinking some straight gin, and it's the smoothest crap ever.
I have got the Sam Adams Rebel IPA. This was in the bargain shopping cart at the local Hy-Vee. The four cans, you know, the 16-ounce cans for like $2.99. So I was like, well, I can't pass that up. So nice stuff coming out of Boston other than just snow right now.
I usually get wrapped up in the Founders line on the all-day IPA because it's so easy, but went a little bit off course with the Centennial here this evening. It's a little warmer, a little bit more delicious going down. That's what we've got. We hope you've got something delicious as we get this episode of TryHards underway. What magic did you guys play? I know you were both on the road. Brian, you had a wedding to travel to, and Matt, you said it was what, just digital cards for you this week?
I didn't get to stream. I actually fell asleep. And yeah.
Makes for a fascinating stream.
It did, in fact. Got to play a couple leagues with the Blue-Black Ashiok. I had the deck ready to go, and I played it online, and I just don't think anything's there. I got to figure something else out, because if I'm going to play Modern, I need to find a deck, and there's just nothing that tickles my fancy yet.
So if you fell asleep before the cast, is that just one punt for the night that covered all of, so that's fewer than usual?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, while you were falling asleep on the couch, I got a chance to play some cards at the LGS. It was a double Modern weekend. F&M was a nice, relaxed Modern get-together, and then on Saturday, they tried to have more of a premium-style event, and it was well-received. Little higher buy-in, top-end focused prize pool payouts, and it brought in enough people for five rounds and then a cut to top eight, which was a fun, deeper format to play, including one of our original Patreon supporters, a Hart of Famer, Michael Barnes, was here. He and his crew, they came over from the Missouri side. In fact, I sent Brian a quick picture text of Michael sporting Brian's ill-fated millstone. I say ill-fated because Brian had to rip a little piece of it out of his soul and send it over to Michael. It was great to see those guys. And I'm going to circle back to a conversation that Michael Barnes and I had during the event. But first, I just kind of want to run through. I played a Mardu Reanimator build of my own making. I like to have fun in Modern. Don't usually play top-tier decks. This thing is black-red and the only white in the deck by the time I got it ready to play was for the flashback on Unburial Rites. So you could think black-red, throwing stuff in the yard, some Fatal Push, some Dreadbore, some Planeswalkers, and then reanimating huge targets in Modern. It was a lot of fun. Round one, I was able to beat a mono-red prison deck in two straight. Round two had an absolute slugfest with mono-green Tron. That was just both of us putting huge fatties into play, knocking the other ones off the board. Really a good time in round two, despite the fact that I didn't pick up the win. Round three, red-black hollow one. That deck, I didn't believe it was as fast as some people were saying. It is really fast. And what's really annoying is when they Burning Inquiry and you have like nine cards in your hand, you roll for which ones get randomly put into the graveyard. Every time he got the perfect three. Every time. I understand if I had won and like had four cards in my hand. I had nine cards in my hand. He would get exactly the cards I needed to play. If I had two answers in a land, he'd get the two answers in the land and strand me with like four unplayable monsters and a couple of sorceries that cost more lands than I had to put in play. So that was just really frustrating to watch that deck sort of get lucky when it burning inquiries against you. And then you're just going, okay, that's fine. Especially when you're a graveyard deck and you're like, sure, if I can just get to three lands, it's fine. I can play out of my own graveyard too, but that never went down. Round four, I learned an important lesson. Don't mulligan to five against eight rack. Did that in both games, and that doesn't go very well.
Lesson learned, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in round five against Nyakord, this was the one that frustrated me. I got game one. He got a very close game two. And then in game three, I was battling back, and finally had a Sire of Insanity, Elish Norn. He had a Restoration Angel in play as his only flyer, but with Elish Norn on the table, it's a 1-2, and I'm at 3 life. So with Sire of Insanity on the board, he's at 4 and can either sit back and let me knock off both of his chump blockers next turn and have no chance to win, or he can top deck exactly Court of Calling. He has nothing that can remove either of my creatures except for Big Game Hunter, and he has no black in order to actually play Big Game Hunter. So it has to be exactly Court of Calling for Big Game Hunter for the win. And as I text Brian, 5 seconds later, I'm signing the match slip with a loss. So that was an extremely frustrating game to take that loss, where I may have made a mistake. Once I had two white sources in play, I didn't think about needing a third because the only white is the flashback cost on burial rights. Well, he drew exactly both of his ghost quarters during the game. And earlier in the game, I had pitched my third white source, my redundant white source, to a Cathartic Reunion in order to draw three. So maybe that was a mistake, because if I'd have been able to pick up a white source, I had two unburial rights sitting in the yard and two monstrous fatties. That game, I would have just waltzed into the winner's circle at that point. Maybe I made that mistake. Maybe it was, if you're trying to play around all the outs, I should have played around the double ghost quarter draw, but it was something I decided not to do, and it ended up ultimately costing me the game because it gave him an out to his only out, which he then hit. So fun deck to play. I think there's something there. If you're imagining in your head, what does this deck look like? It's somewhere between Bob Huang's Grishol brand out-and-out combo deck and sort of Mardu Pyromancer, where it's a control, small ball, get there in incremental ways, where this one looks to just use the reanimation package to go big, put bigger threats into play than can be Fatal Push, that can be commonly removed by the most played cards in the format as far as removal goes. And then you can just get incremental value from there. A lot of fun to play, and I'll probably keep working on that. While we were at the tournament, guys, I mentioned the conversation I had with Hart of Famer Michael Barnes. He's an accounting professor at a mid-sized state university in Missouri, and he was telling me that he wants to open an LGS. Now, whether he gets to do that as his retirement gig or can do it before that is what we were really talking about. And I mentioned to him that Matt and I have played at an LGS that operates exclusively on weekends, so as a part-time LGS. He hadn't thought about going that route and said that might open up an opportunity for him earlier than he thought. Matt, you've done a lot of research into possible LGSs, whether it's been in Quincy or in other markets. In fact, you've even gone so far as to look at a possible franchise licensing and opening one up at one point. You decided to take your career in a different direction. Is there any advice that you would give to somebody who is seriously thinking about and financially has the building blocks in place should they choose to go this route?
I can't tell anyone it's a good idea. I hate to put it like that, but it's a tough gig. I think the most important is to have somebody who have the willingness to spend 20 hours a weekend, 30 hours a weekend for free at your LGS, which is you own, service it yourself, do as much as you can yourself, and then be willing to do that as a labor of love versus a labor of making money. I think that's the most important part that people don't even think about. I've tried every which way to make it work, and I've never been able to, and I've never been able to figure out the math to make it work. If he does it, good luck. I hope everything works out well for him, but I just don't know how financially how you can make it work without having essentially, you break even or lose money, slight money on it, and spend a lot of your free time there.
Now, I know none of the three of us are LGS owners, and none of us have really lived the card shop life either, but we did have Stone, the proprietor and owner of For the Win in Galesburg, Brian's local LGS, on the show some time ago when he had announced that he was, for various reasons, closing the LGS there, or at least looking to move it into his partner's hands full time. Brian, you kind of went through the ups and downs of watching your local game store close slash change hands and then become a part-time game store. Were you put off by the part-time nature of it, or is that something that a community would accept rather than having nothing?
I'm absolutely happy to have something over nothing, the first and foremost thing I would say. It is annoying. Earlier in the week, sometimes it's easier for me to get down to the store. But as I've said before on this cast, I'm not the primary audience. I'm an older person who doesn't get to play it that much. I'm not going to be in there every night, or, you know, when they put an event up, I'm not going to be the regular person to go to the wacky drafts and to go to the standard and the FNMs and things like that. That's just my schedule doesn't allow it. When I can get down there is usually when a door that's part-time is going to be open, just like a full-time store. So to me, it doesn't even seem like it's only open, you know, part-time. I know, though, that some people are pretty down on the part-time aspect because they're looking to play more than once or twice a week. They're feeling pretty cheated out of their Monday through Wednesday nights not being able to go down to an LGS and sling cardboard.
By the way, Michael did confide in me. He said he loves the try-hard playmat, and the biggest problem he has, since he's made it his de facto EDH playmat, is mopping up the pools of drool from his fellow competitors who are,
nice.
Who are so jealous of it. So, Michael, thanks for being a supporter, and we wish you well when you decide to go that route and tackle that labor of love of operating in LGS. That brings us up to this week's tournaments. GP Sydney saw Team Unified Modern. You can't play a card that's in your teammate's deck. That's the easiest definition for Unified. It came down to 350 teams to battle it out. And in my mind, here's the key question when you look at Unified. What decks don't share mana bases? And when you start divvying it up that way, some decks, well, they started to become obvious because they were powerful, but they don't tread on any other mana base in the format. Humans? Check. Nobody else is using Ancient Ziggurat, so you're good for takeoff. The eventual winners, Jessica Estefan, Ryan Lewis Jans, and Lachlan Sanders. They were on Black Red Hollow One, Humans, and Mono Green Tron. No worries about the mana bases overlapping each other there. Defeated Aiden Frisch, James O'Rourke, and Jacob Golding. They were on Grixis Control, Green Red Tron, and Affinity. Again, mana bases not overlapping there. This was interesting, guys. Not only do we owe a congratulations to Jessica Estefan becoming the first woman GP winner in Australia over the weekend, we also saw some interesting takes in this final four. You have three decks per team in the final four, so we end up with a nice round top 12. Humans had two more lists in that final four. We saw Blue Moon, Living End, Dredge, and Titan Shift. When you end up with that, and with what we saw at GP Hartford, I know we're skipping ahead a little bit to reveal some details from Hartford, but guys, there was one huge hole. The previous boogeyman in the format is nowhere to be found. Death Shadow? You couldn't even find its shadow at a top table throughout these two GPs. Brian, has the format simply moved on from Shadow, no matter what shell you put it in?
I think Death Shadow is almost kind of set the benchmark for being a hyper-efficient deck. That was not the easiest one to play. There were a lot of micro decisions that you had to make. If you had the choice to play Death Shadow or something with just as much synergy, such as Mardu Pyromancer or Kark Clan Ironworks or the Black Red Hollow One deck, I think everybody would just kind of pick one of the latter. Death Shadow just seems to be a little bit outclassed at its own game, and I think those three decks I mentioned are probably better at doing the Death Shadow thing than Death Shadow itself.
Matt, I know I grabbed the low-hanging fruit when I said the first thing you look for is mana bases that don't eat each other's choices up, but beyond that, is there a special knack to picking decks in a team format where you're all playing the same format, Modern in this case? Does it polarize your deck choices? Or do you just get players to go with what they know and what they're good with?
I think you get one or two players to go with what they know, and then the other player or players kind of picks okay, what can I build that doesn't include all of this? In this particular meta, I think that's why we didn't get any of the like the Jund matchups, because Jund eats up a lot of mana bases. It eats up a lot of the different cards out of some of these decks. I think that's a big reason why we didn't see Jund. You just pick one player, maybe your strongest, you pick one, and then you go with what you know, and then the rest of the players pick what they're strong with, and then you know, hopefully everyone kind of comes out and you do some practicing with those. Congratulations to the first woman GP winner, not to crap on the other two players, because they it was a team event. I have interacted on Twitter with Jessica before, and she's always got some interesting deck choices, and she has an interesting view of the game as well. But she's been a very good player hiding in Australia, and congratulations to her.
Yes, you're right, Matt. Congrats to Jessica, but we can't leave Ryan and Lachlan off either. It was a team event, all three of them taking down GP Sydney. Meanwhile, in Hartford, it was an individual GP, Modern again, the format. 1,819 players. Guys, incidentally, this is going to be the new try-hard tracker. 97 went home without a point. Our hearts go out to them as well. It was Matt Nass on KCI, Kart Clan Ironworks, 2-1-ing Michael Mapson on Titan Ship. These are just two ships passing in the night. Combo decks trying to do their thing and race to the finish line before the other one can do it. Not too much interaction. Well, until you sat down and watched a wild and woolly game three between these two, that alone is worth going back and looking at the archive for in this final. So with Mapson on Titan Shift and Nass on KCI, the rest of the top 16 was Burn, two Bogles decks that were in the top 8, two Black Red Hollow One, Affinity Elves, a second copy of Titan Shift, Blue Moon, Living End, Blue Black Taking Turns, Humans, Mardu, Pyromancer, and Jund. Again, no Death Shadow anywhere to be found. That means Titan Shift, Hollow One, and Bogles were the only decks with duplicate copies in the top 16. Yes, the modern format is wide open. Ryan stated his case earlier, Matt. Do you have an idea of why Death Shadow has just fallen off the landscape?
Maybe it's Humans. I also think this Hollow One deck, I played against it a bunch, and Sean, I have the same feeling you have. I don't know how that kind of flew under the radar for so long, because the cards have been in modern for now a few months. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a combination of bad matchups and people aren't playing it.
It'll be interesting to see if the ascendancy of Hollow One is enough to push a Braid into the format. I know that's a card I've been talking about in both Modern and in Legacy and its uses for quite a while now. Brian, how much of the cast did you get to watch over the weekend? I had three takeaways. Number one, I loved the inclusion of the staff of announcers doing a pick'em, which deck they thought would take the tournament down. And congratulations to Maria Bartholdi, as she won the first one by picking her pet deck, Bogles. Two copies in the top 8 gave her the win in that. I loved something they introduced, the card of the match. They had the analyst pick out what they thought the card of the match was each round. I thought it was a fun twist and a way to highlight the really powerful card that took it down for the winner. What I didn't like, I was very busy on Saturday. Between my own modern tournament and some other things that I had going on, I was looking forward to, after the rest of the house was quiet, watching the rerun on Saturday night. Well, I didn't get to, because the stream went bad and WotC never fixed it. I know WotC personally doesn't oversee the broadcasts for these, but ultimately, the ball lies in their court for the GP coverage. Now, maybe it's their broadcast partner's responsibility as well, but when you're looking at a black screen on what should be an all-hours rerun leading up to day two, I thought that was a major miss, that there was no technical addressing of that issue. Did you have any thoughts you took away from the tournament over the weekend?
I agree with you. The big black screen that I was faced with was not very pleasant to watch, and just kind of, you know, you're kind of looking around saying, is this, am I getting punked here? Is this, you know, a bad joke, etc.? Again, Modern always surprises me with how versatile so many decks are, and if you've got a good deck that you're good at playing, just go with that. There's no one best deck in Modern, and I think Matt Nass just shows that he's a really, really good player and a great combo player, as Bartholdi called him this weekend, and I think he showed that. I was really, really happy with the coverage this weekend. I loved seeing the mishmash of personalities on camera at all times. Marshall was paired with, I don't know, four different people, I want to say. And I thought they all, you know, lended themselves very, very well to the coverage as a whole. the play, I thought, was really, really solid all the way through. We had some names that we saw and we've seen through the SCG grind. We've seen some names that we've seen at GPs before, obviously. But the play I saw from people who are not household names, I thought was really, really tight. Couple of things here and there that the commentators even might have said something like, oh, I think he missed having lethal there. Well, we'll see if he can get it next round. They were kind of rooting for, you know, people just to make the good plays. So overall, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was a good tournament, good coverage. And I do agree, the pick'em things, both cards and for decks, I thought is something they should stay with. It just kind of brings a lightness to the coverage and a way to kind of have some fun banter going back and forth, a la what Patrick and Cedric do on the SCG Tour.
Yeah, and anytime you can have people who are watching or involved sort of pick hashtag whatever, Black Red Hollow One or Tron or Burn or whatever it is, you have some personal investment in the outcome, and that makes people more interested, and they'll typically stay with those broadcasts longer. And ultimately, that's what Magic wants from this. That's what WotC wants from this, is engagement and people watching their product and getting excited to interact with and play with that product on their own. So I would say that's been a great hit this first weekend. That brings us to this week's news, which is going to circle back to what we were just talking about with the two tournaments. The banned and restricted announcement came out today, and it was just an empty piece of white paper for me and Duke. No changes in any format. There's been much discussion, especially in Legacy, about the validity of Deathrite Shaman, and even in some circles, Brainstorm. And we've had part of that discussion here. But what I want to focus on, because Modern was in the spotlight this weekend, gentlemen, is what I consider a card that should be up for debate in Modern, and that is Ancient Stirrings. I say it is now time for an intervention. For a single green sorcery, you get to look at the top five cards of your library and put a colorless card, reminder, lands are colorless, into your hand. Ponder and Preordain are banned for being too strong in enabling decks that are too consistent in the format, despite the fact that they're both from the color that represents the card drawing, card selection portion of the color pie. Stirrings, though, gets a pass despite 1, looking deeper into the deck, 2, giving you a larger relevant selection of cards, and 3, not coming from the card drawing selection part of the color pie. Yes, all three are 1-mana sorceries, and let's be honest, there's a deck-building cost to make sure that Ancient Stirrings is working for you. But that cost has gone from an irrelevant triviality to an absolute strength of the deck because you can play with so many colorless cards in Modern. I say it's been nice knowing you, Ancient Stirrings, but you are a more egregious violator than either Ponder or Preordain. Matt, where do you come down on the Ancient Stirring stopping, as we just had no bannings?
I do think it needs to go. I mean, it's too powerful, and it does everything too well. The whole no bans, I mean, I'm a little shocked they didn't ban Deathrite from Legacy. I do kind of wish they would have. I think it would have made the format a little more balanced out, but yeah, I do think Ancient Stirrings is kind of saw its day in the sun and it's time to go.
I just don't agree with that. I really don't. I don't think we've seen Ancient Stirrings decks that are warping the format in any way, shape, or form. And I think until that happens, there's really no reason to ban the card. I totally get what you're saying, Sean and Harley. In a color that does not value selection or card drawing power, it gives you both of those things. But the fact that it's revealing a colorless card, I think, is the drawback. Players have taken that to do something very, very powerful with it, to go get their Ugins, to go get their Ulamogs, to go get the land that they need for Tron, etc. That is a powerful thing. However, it's not too powerful. I feel like the drawback to the building with this, and it's a sorcery speed, I think there's definitely ways to interact with this. There's definitely ways to play around this. And it's not like Ancient Stirrings, again, is just become that common that has shot up to $20, $30 because, you know, people just can't get enough of this card and it's going into every deck because it's just that good. No, there's a lot of really, really good cards in Modern, and they all kind of have to synergize with a bunch of the other cards that are in the 60-card deck. And so, no, I wouldn't call for a ban. I would say watch and see, and if it's the power level starts to creep up, I'd be totally open for having that discussion.
See, Brian, I disagree. You look at a card like Ponder, believed to be the stronger of the two, Ponder and Preordain. It lets you look at the top three cards of your library, put one into your hand, and the other two back on top, or shuffle your library and get a blind draw. None of those drawbacks are in any way, shape, or form part of Ancient Stirrings. In the decks that it's played in a worst-case scenario, you have four choices because you were unlucky enough to see another Ancient Stirrings amongst those five cards that you looked at, and you're not even bound to draw those cards and be, quote-unquote, Ancient Stirrings locked, if I can borrow half of the brainstorm lock analogy from Legacy. You get to put them on the bottom of your library and keep churning through your deck looking for more and more answers. I think Ancient Stirrings is by far more powerful than either Ponder or Preordain, the only drawback, quote-unquote, being that it is limited to colorless cards. But while that might have been a limiting factor in a standard format, in a modern format in which you can play with 56 colorless cards and four Ancient Stirrings, let's be honest, you've taken what was supposed to be a drawback and turned it into an actual propeller that makes the card more than it was ever intended to be.
The thing about that, though, is if you look at the decks that are winning GPs, they're not Ancient Stirring focused up and down, you know, from first through eighth and even 9 through 16. They're just not that focused. There is some drawback to this. The green Tron decks, which I think are the strongest of the Tron variants right now, do benefit from this. And I think that's the definite advantage over like a colorless Eldrazi build at the moment, because they do offer that. What it does not allow you to do is set the top of your deck like a Ponder or a Preordain. I think if we had Ponder or Preordain in the format, you'd have Modern Miracles wrecking people's days, and there would be a ban coming out of nowhere just because people are like, no, we do not want to have that. You're going to drive people away from the game. That would be format warping. The fact that you have to put these cards on the bottom of your library, to me, it's just the same as hitting and missing with Company. There's a lot of times on camera when someone, you know, is facing down lethal and they've got a Company in their hand, they Company and they draw blanks. I think that's just the variance of the game. It just happens sometimes. So with Ancient Stirrings, yeah, I agree. It's powerful. I'm willing to watch it. But until we start seeing that first through eighth place finishes be all Stirrings decks and how many copies of Stirrings are in the top eight, just like we do with Deathrite Shaman and some other cards in Legacy, I don't think we need to be having to ban this conversation.
All right. Stirrings was in the championship teams deck in Sydney, in the runner-up teams decks in Sydney, and was littered around the top 16 at GP Hartford as well. So we'll keep our eye on Ancient Stirrings. And I'm going to sound like an old curmudgeon here, Brian, but you brought it up, Collected Company. We go back to the color pie argument, and the fact that green can play over the top at instant speed also just kind of turns my stomach a little bit.
You know, don't get me started on that card. In some ways, Ancient Stirrings was printed at a time when, you know, Magic was in a different stage then, right? Ancient Stirrings was never even a card sure. that played that much. When Company was printed, everybody's looking at this going, seriously? Green gets to do this? It was kind of one of those like, hey, middle finger to blue for a couple sets, right? You know, for 18 months, that's all you saw was Company decks. And I think that was a card that was almost going to get the ban hammer, if I remember right. But it was just kind of, you know, it was the end of its run. It was going to just kind of phase out naturally due to rotation. So, yeah, that card to me, in some ways, because it puts cards directly onto the battlefield, makes it extremely more powerful. Granted, it's four, and I know Ancient Stirrings is one, but instant speed putting cards directly onto the battlefield can be a much more powerful interaction in modern than Ancient Stirrings.
Well, you also have to take a look at the ripple effect. Because that color is in green, what does green do? Green gets overpowered, undercosted creatures. So you now get to use Collected Company to put overpowered, undercosted creatures. So it becomes this sort of tombstone stairwell that you're always sort of spiraling down the whole way. So one card choice that enables the actual ability, focus, and strength of that color in a novel way. And it does give good gameplay, but you start having these conversations about cards that are too good, they break the color pie, and all of these things. I think it enables a lot of pondering over what could be done with the banned and restricted list. Matt, are there any other cards?
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I know. Matt, are there any other cards that you think should either be put in jail or maybe taken out of jail? Is we get to have this conversation a couple times a year with this announcement.
I don't know. On the modern side, I don't know. I mean, everyone says it. Modern is just you take your deck and you play, hope your deck draws well. I mean, that's kind of what modern is as a whole. It's not very interactive.
I think it's interactive. It's hard to interrupt, like, Matt Nass going off on his Kart Clan Ironworks combo. Kind of like, where do I interrupt this whole thing? And with the whole idea of priority, it's pretty hard for, you know, maybe a newbie player to be like, yeah, I'm not sure what I should be doing right here. That's the only thing. It's kind of like that play style idea. However, I still feel like there's interaction to be had. In the hands of Matt Nass, that deck just absolutely hums, but it's not going to happen that way with everybody. How many people were playing Death Shadow that were not playing it very, very well? I played against a few people, and it's a little ugly when it's not played well. I think you have to get the reps in, and so no matter what deck you've got, if you don't have the reps in, it can just turn into kind of a meh deck, you know, any day of the week, honestly. I know that there's all kinds of talk going on right now in the Vintage community about Workshop. They should just restrict Workshop, and, you know, the people who are pro Workshop people have staked their ground, and the people who are anti Workshop have staked their ground. And, you know, if I see some violence happening on the evening news, I think my first thought might be going to, well, it finally happened. They got out their $30,000 sets and just went to town on each other. I don't see anything right now that's really concerning. I love the fact that it's a haven to brew in Modern still. It's going to be a haven to brew in Standard, obviously, with all the new cards coming in. I'm kind of happy they didn't ban Deathrite Shaman in Legacy, even though I abhor playing against that card. There are ways around it, and I think I'm just banned out, guys. I really am with WotC over the last 2 years. I just don't want to see any more bans coming down and lose that consumer confidence. So anytime we talk of bannings, I hope it's for a really, really good reason.
None of us are Vintage players, but I would say WotC knew that Damping Sphere was coming, and they want to see if that's going to help clamp down on Workshop in Vintage. I think that's going to be maybe a format where it becomes main deckable just because of the power of Workshop. We'll see how that all plays out. Should be rather interesting 4-6 months from now when the next Banned and Restricted update comes around. That brings us up to this week's In the Elevator, and as we wait for it to come to the ground floor, guys, I want you to look in your packs and make sure that you've got your lands, your basic lands, pre-sleeved and ready to go for this weekend's pre-release. That's our tip from us to you. Take your own basic lands, pre-sleeved, and the sleeves you're going to play saves you time sleeving up, and you're ready to go from the jump when you get to open up your packs for pre-release this weekend. The elevator's here. Matt, what's in the elevator this week?
So I'm going to pick one from Dominaria since it's pre-release. Tempest Djinn. This is the 3 blue 04 flying that gets +1/+0 for each island you control. I think this one's going to be a big player. Currently, it's about 50 cents on TCG Player. Throw somebody a buck and give me that playset that you guys opened, or just randomly trade for some janky stuff that's rotating out. So I think this card's really underrated, and I'd say pick it up this weekend at your pre-release.
Did Matt find it in his teapot? We'll never know. Tempest Djinn, this week's In the Elevator here on Tryhards. Matt, I want you to give us a bonus, just a quick flash on your thoughts. One of the things I was happy to do over the weekend, I came away with a handful of the new Full Art Foil promo ops from my tournament. I had one as a door prize and then was able to pick a couple other ones up while I was there during the day. Even though opt is, what, printed at common, are those going to be a hot commodity?
I wouldn't go with hot commodity, but I will go with, I think they're going to be pretty desirable. I think actually they did a hell of a job picking all the cards this time for what they're going to, what the various promos are. The game day promo, if I remember right, was a little weak. I think you're safe picking up any of these, and I think it's, if you have the chance, it's worth going to get these cards. So definitely the opt, pretty heavy dose of play in Modern as well.
A bonus talk. Thank you very much, Matt. You can go ahead and bill us for overtime this week here on Tryhards. That brings us up to 3 minutes to brew. Brian, I know you. You're looking forward to Dominaria this weekend. What do you got for us this week?
I cannot seem to get off the green cards, everybody. And I know I'm kind of a is it mage at heart, but I tell you what, when they keep printing cards like this, it's hard to ignore green. I'm looking at the sorcery green, Sylvan Awakening. 1 green and 2 generic mana. Until your next turn, all lands you control become 2/2 elemental creatures with reach, indestructible, and Haste, there's still lands. I feel like this is one of those game-ending cards, late game, obviously, but also one of those cards mid-game at three casting costs that can completely swing the tempo. And I could see this being a limited, a standard, and maybe even a modern player. So, am I overthinking Sylvan Awakening, Sean?
The first card that popped into my mind was Cormis Bell. And for those who don't remember that from the old days, it's a four-drop artifact, made all your swamps 1/1 creatures that were still swamps. That gave way to some absolute blowouts if your now creature lands would die. You were reading off Sylvan Awakening, and the other answer that popped right into my mind was Golden Demise. That plays right around Indestructible. All creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn. I would be too fearful of having my lands turn to creatures and then getting blown out and stranded for the rest of the game unless it was an ability to win on that turn. Is this going to be a last-ditch effort, win out of nowhere? I don't know if green wants to play that way. Is this an answer for maybe a control deck that gets to turn their lands into 2/2s and you only have to really play around Settle the Wreckage? I think if this is used, it'll be used as a one of because it has too much of a dangerous downside otherwise.
I can definitely see the positives in this because they're indestructible, they have haste, and they have reach. I do agree with Sean in the sense that you want to play this when you're going to win. I haven't seen a lot of sweepers in this format that are -X/-X that look like they're playable. There's a new one, like an Infest style one coming out, but I don't think that that's going to be a big player. I don't see a reason not to play this in your green decks. And I could even see a green-white deck with the triple green and triple white card. I think those cards are going to be powerful, and being able to have your 5/4 that's just beating down, and then you can transfer that into all your creatures get +1/+1, and then you transfer that into all of a sudden all my creatures are 2/2s. I think that's a huge thing. I could also see green-red with Siege Gang Commander, Goblin Warchief style as well, because I think that could be the reach that these Goblin decks really, really need.
Golden Demise and something like Settle the Wreckage, I think, would absolutely ruin your day if you're going to go kind of an all-in plan like this wants you to do. I love the fact that this has haste and indestructible, and that's the key words to me that does this, because you can kind of alpha strike in, and your opponent's going to have to throw some things in their way. You're still going to keep your lands until your next turn, and so therefore, if you have some way to, you know, untap those lands, untap those creatures, I think you're going to be sitting pretty. Otherwise, yeah, it might be a long day for you. I think the green-white, Hurley, like you said, the Banalish Hero, the three-white version that gives all your creatures 1/1. Army of 3/3s versus an army of 2/2s could make a big difference, I think, especially in a limited format. So that's something that's exciting. I'm excited about this card just because of the wild swings that it could offer. But I understand that there might be some blowouts that happen, and I kind of want to be there leaning over the guy's shoulder saying, well, better you than me.
So do you think Golden Demise is going to see heavy play? Because I don't see a lot of X2 creatures running around. I mean, there's a decent amount, but I don't see a team play just because I don't see a ton of X2s. I see a lot of, like, 4-butts, and then there's some X1s. I mean, do you see it, the format going to that?
Oh, I could see it if it becomes a very token-heavy format. Golden Demise is going to go in those decks that don't care about -2/-2 on their big toughness creatures. It's just going to try to sweep the board away of the small stuff to get out of the way and then pound in for whatever damage it can do with the demons and other things. I could see this being a card going forward, especially with Ascend in the late game. Giving all of your opponent's creatures -2/-2 could be a huge thing. Especially if they're looking to take a game late, Golden Demise might be what, you know, takes them out of that game.
Yeah, to me, Golden Demise's future is tied entirely to the viability of Merfolk and Vampires, because they're the go wide decks, it seems, in my mind. You can answer Pirates, but Pirates haven't really been a thing so far. So I think Golden Demise's value in gold is great if Vampires and Merfolk become threats, and not so much if you're dealing with Dinosaurs and other things with 3 and 4 butts.
So I know Hurley got a little bit of a bonus section there, Sean, so can you indulge me for 1 second? There's a card that almost made the cut for 3 minutes to brew, and I just want to get your quick 30-second take on it, gentlemen. Champion of the Flame, kind of the Kiln Fiend of the Dominaria set. We have a 1-1 human warrior for a red and a generic. Trample gets 2-2 for each aura and equipment attached to it. I feel like this card could be absolutely bonkers left unchecked.
We really haven't seen that much in the vein of equipment. There's a few pieces, but nothing amazing. So I think this all depends on what auras you're going to be using from the previous sets and from this set.
Yeah, it reminds me of Pure Steel Champion in a way. Is this the card that came to mind when you were mentioning that? We'll see if people want to play that Theros style, stack up your big creature magic.
I hope I get one in my pre-release pack because I'm definitely going to see if I can make equipments work, especially with that red-white legend that returns all enchantments or equipment to your hand after it hits the graveyard. Seems like a pretty good combo.
Bonus 3 minutes to brew this week here on Tryhards. That brings us up to what we did to get better at magic this week. For me, it was using the relative distance after playing in a tournament to logically think through plays that I made, to evaluate things with a calm mind. You might be frustrated in the moment when your opponent hits a one-outer, but did you give them the room to hit it by making a misplay earlier in the game? You have to be willing to consider those things if you want to get better at Magic, and it was taking that time that helped me get better at Magic this week. Matt, you were able to play some digital cards this week. What'd you do to get better at Magic?
I still haven't played paper cards. I think that's making me a little bit better. I can't wait to do the pre-release this weekend, but I wasn't getting a little burnt out as much as I was getting just kind of like, I'm not interested in standard. I'm not interested that much in modern. What am I going to play type of thing? No, I'm really looking forward to Dominaria here, and I'm looking forward to being able to go into a fresh standard format with Dominaria.
Ryan, what were you thinking about while you were driving the family around?
Altered cards. I've joined a couple groups. It's just kind of like a little pet thing of mine to find out what's out there in the altered cards and rare and strange little MTG cards. And I don't know if it makes me better at Magic, but it sure does get me excited for this game to see what kind of artwork people are putting on our beloved cardboard. I think it's one of those things that has always drawn me to the game, as the artwork has gotten infinitely better over the years, though there are those early cards that I still gravitate toward. The excitement that I can get over a good piece of altered artwork, I think, is something that I have to evaluate for myself and be like, huh, do I really like the art in this game, or do I like the game itself? And it always comes back to, no, I do like the game itself, and I'll continue to play it. But putting your own personal stamp on a deck, whether it's foiling it out, whether it's having all altered, whether it's having all signed cards, things of that nature, I think is a really fun aspect of the game. And getting away from the competitive side and, you know, playing with the deck that you love, I think is always a fun thing to remember. And hey, you all do you, and if that's something you want to do, put that deck together. I'd love to see it at the next tournament.
Oh, you brave soul, may you find peace when Magic returns to its original home. And may you find some wins as well this weekend. We'll see you next week here on Tryhards.